Okay, we're back on tape again. So how long did you actually spend in your graduate work?
I was there, it's a total of little over 6 years total. So in Don's lab, basically 5 years.
Yeah. That's pretty average.
Just average, yeah. Wasn't.
I mean, you make it sound like you're really slow. You know?
Well, I mean, I think just the nature of you know, what was accomplished made, you know, mm-hmm. I guess it wasn't, but I mean, you know, certainly I think by Don's standards, you know, I think he would have been happy if things had happened much faster. And, you know, in retrospect, probably, but I just didn't know how to do a lot of things, and I would just, for me to get things done, I really need to really understand them in sort of this a very deep way, and that just, I get held up. And that's not a good thing necessarily, and I've gotten better about that. You know, you often can, I actually have found now that you can get things done and maybe not understand everything totally deeply, and then go back, and then later on you realize, you know, you learn that way too, and you don't have to do it in such a rigid linear way that I think I was doing at that time. And that's something I really did take away from that lab, I think, in part. Uh-huh. So it was very important, actually, because I think that is important. You know, when you have to make these judgments and when you should just leap ahead and then sort of go back and look retrospectively. Because it is just so easy to get, bogged down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here you are now. You're graduating from your doctoral program. And now you have to figure out
what to do.
Yeah.
Right. So, well, as you saw from my CV, I did two postdocs, and this is a little complicated. So what happened was that because I had done this refinement, spent a lot of time working on this refinement stuff, I really got interested in it as a problem. And I always had this interest in the sort of, as I mentioned, I had worked with Martin Karpus a little bit in some of the computational stuff. So what happened was that I met Wayne Hendrickson. John Kurian is a very close friend of mine. He's a crystallographer. He's at Rockefeller. We were in grad school together. Mm-hmm. And John spent his whole thesis with Karpus and a collaboration with Greg Petsko, who was at that time at MIT, doing refinement methodology. And so I would hang around with him a lot, and I knew what was going on. And at John's thesis committee, Wayne was actually came up from New York for John's thesis because they had sort of been in touch. And I met Wayne, and Wayne was sort of the person who kind of had really invented refinement. Mm-hmm. And I met him, and we really hit it off. And I thought it would be a really interesting lab to work in because he was starting to develop this anomalous scattering methodology for solving the phase problem, which I'll come back to later.
Okay.
So I chatted with Wayne a little bit, and I decided that, you know, that would be a place I could really imagine doing a postdoc. And what happened was also I just didn't, when I looked around, and partly this was this kind of partial brainwashing that, you know, oh, there's no one else doing anything interesting, you know. but really the only two people in the end I really was interested in doing a postdoc with Wayne and Dave McKay, who's actually my colleague next door here, ironically enough, who at that time was at Boulder because he had done some really interesting structures in the mid-80s. And so I went out to Dave's lab to interview with him and then Wayne. And I settled on Wayne's lab. So I had actually done all of this while I was still in Don's lab. But what happened was that I really wanted to do this refinement stuff, and I wasn't really happy with a lot of the methodology we were using. And because of my contacts with the Karpus group, I had met Axel Brünger, who was at that time a postdoc with Martin Karpus. And he and John Kurian share an office. Okay, so I knew him kind of through John. And John and Axel had developed this so-called simulated annealing refinement. And this is let me take a few steps back. So this problem of refinement is it's a multidimensional least squares problem. It's a nonlinear least squares problem. And what that means is that you have a model that describes your data, and the idea is that you adjust the parameters of the model to best fit the experimental data. So you ultimately adjust the parameters of the model to best match the experimental observations, and that is not a well-determined problem in the sense that in a case like a protein molecule, you can't just run this program and get the absolute global minimum of, the absolute best match of the data in the global sense. So you go into what's called the local minimum. Okay, you're minimizing the discrepancy between the model mm-hmm. and the observation, mm-hmm. and you can just locally find the minimum discrepancy. Mm-hmm. And that's a fundamental problem that affects many, many fields of this class of problem, not only in protein crystallography. So in the early 80s, a group at IBM, based on some statistical mechanics analogies, had developed a thing called simulated annealing, where you basically, the analogy is that you take a glass, and if you just, let me stop there. That's not a good analogy for this. The basic idea is that if you take a system and you just minimize it, it would be like kind of taking a liquid and then cooling it down and you get, a glass. Mm-hmm. But the actual the really lowest energy state would be a crystal, for example. Okay, everything's really well ordered, or can be. And so the basic idea is that what do you do in practice experimentally? Well, you would take that and maybe heat it up a little bit. You would anneal it. You'd heat it up and then let it cool down slowly, and try to find something that would be more ordered. Okay, that's what and so mathematically you can do the same thing by essentially imparting heat or energy into it, kinetic energy. Mm-hmm. And heating up the system and letting it relax. And what happens, if you think about a molecule now, with balls and springs, is that what we're doing, if you just minimize your model, is that mm-hmm. you're letting it relax to the nearest minimum. And it's not going to drift very far, because everything's tied together with with springs. If you impart kinetic energy to it, the springs are moving all around, and it's going to search more of its kind of conformational space. And then you slowly cool it down, and you may find a better minimum, okay, that more closely matches the data. And that's called simulated annealing, the mathematical procedure. And Axel and John had applied this using what's called molecular dynamics simulations to the refinement problem. Mm-hmm. And I thought this would be a fantastic thing to do with this large problem, hemagglutinin, we were working on. And Axel and I had chatted about doing it mm-hmm. when we were both still at Harvard. I was writing my thesis, though. He was moving to Yale. Mm-hmm. We didn't have time. Mm-hmm. So I decided to spend a year, a first postdoc with him, and work on this there. Mm-hmm. So I went down there for a year to work on this methodology, knowing I was going to Wayne's lab afterwards. Mm-hmm. And what we did is worked out the methodology. And we had to add some new things, like it turns out there's something called non-crystallographic symmetry in this problem and in many problems where you have the same copy within the repeating unit of the crystal, so-called asymmetric unit of the crystal. You can have multiple copies of the molecule. Hemagglutinin is a trimer. There are three copies of it in the asymmetric unit. And you can use the fact that they all look identical as a restraint in this procedure. Mm. And we had to build that into the program. So I spent time writing code to do that with him. And we did that, and it was very successful. And we got a much better model of hemagglutinin out of it mm-hmm. as a result. Mm-hmm. So that's what I spent the year at Yale doing. Mm-hmm. And I also started to work on some other methodology, which was later picked up by another postdoc of Axel's, in solvent corrections in refinement. And I worked on that as well with him. So it was really sort of kind of an extension of my thesis work more than anything, but I really wanted to do this. So I spent a year there at mm-hmm. Yale writing code, mm-hmm. working on the refinement, did that. That's what the JMB paper I sent you mm-hmm. was. Then I moved to Wayne's lab. Mm-hmm. Basically a year to the...
Which is at Columbia.
At Columbia, right? Medical School, mm-hmm. right. Right, and I was there for 4 years, which was fantastic. That was probably the best time of my life.
Totally.
Yeah, I love... Well, I was back in New York, which I had missed.
Yeah.
And Wayne, I just love. He's just great. So the whole experience was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I went there to... Well, there were two things. One is that all this anomalous scattering methodology was being developed, and I had an opportunity to actually be very involved with it in the early days. I actually wrote some programs to sort of extend the methodology a bit and work on this problem with Kurt Drickamer, our then collaborator, who is still my collaborator to this day. And what happened there was really that I had met Kurt. He had come up to Harvard to give a seminar. And Kurt works on what are called C-type lectins, these calcium-dependent lectins. So I was working on carbohydrate recognition with Don at the time. And I met Kurt, and we were chatting. And he was working on this family of proteins, which included a very interesting receptor called the asialoglycoprotein receptor, which is found in the liver. It binds, it removes circulating glycoproteins from the blood. And Kurt was developing, he really wanted to do structures of these things. It was an unknown structure, really wanted to get information about mechanism and the like. And this was a perfect match for my interest, carbohydrate recognition, cell recognition, which I had really gotten interested in with Wayne, with Don, excuse me. And he wanted to do this, and he was just down the hall, so it was a great situation to walk into. So I was in Wayne's lab collaborating with Kurt on those molecules. So what we did is that Kurt had actually worked out an expression system for this molecule, another member of the family called mannose binding protein. That protein's actually found in our serum, and it's involved in recognizing pathogenic cell surfaces. It recognizes sugar structures on the surfaces that we don't have. And it's a way of distinguishing pathogens from our own cells through carbohydrates rather than through an antibody response. And ultimately, it triggers cell killing by mechanisms similar to how antibodies trigger cell killing. So it's a host defense protein. And Kurt had figured out how to make the business end of this molecule, namely the part that recognizes sugars. And we had a bacterial expression system. And I spent a year trying to follow up with some bad crystals that another postdoc had grown on success. You know, it didn't work out. And then we figured out we had to modify the protein, and we did that and got great crystals and started working on it. What happened there was that these proteins require calcium for their function, and we knew that. And the obvious thing, so when you're doing a new protein structure, what you have to do is introduce heavy atoms into the protein to perturb the diffraction. And if you can measurably perturb the diffraction with one of these heavy atoms, it turns out if you can do this, compare the diffraction of the perturbed and the native crystals, you can extract the phase information you need to reconstruct an image of the protein. And so you need to have these heavy atoms in there. So the obvious thing if you have a calcium binding protein is you put in something to substitute for the calcium that's heavier, which are called lanthanide ions, and we put in lanthanides. And it turned out that at that, so that's a bit of the background for this. Then what happened was that Wayne, one of the reasons I had gone to his lab, was starting to develop this method called multi-wavelength anomalous scattering phasing, or dispersion phasing, or MAD phasing. And what this method does is, I just described that what you have to do to solve a structure normally is add a heavy atom and perturb the diffraction compared to the native. Well, there's a phenomenon that you can measure from heavy atoms called anomalous scattering, which is a wavelength-dependent phenomenon where you get, when you're near the absorption transitions in the particular element, you basically, in a so-called absorption edge, you absorb energy of a particular wavelength. And it kicks an electron out of its inner orbital, and then it relaxes back, so it absorbs energy. And that absorption actually has an effect on the measurable diffraction, because basically what's called normal X-ray scattering, that we sort of would deal with ignoring this effect, treats the electrons as though they're not even in orbitals, as though they're free electrons. Okay, so this is really a quantum effect of being bound in orbitals and kicking them out. And it turns out that that phenomenon is measurable, and it turns out that if you can measure this as a function of energy, or as a function of wavelength, the same thing, energy and wavelength are the same, you can actually extract phase information from those differences. If you measure it at one wavelength versus another, the difference in this anomalous scattering effect can give you the same kind of phase information that you would get from taking two crystals, one with and one without a heavy atom. The beauty of this is that you just need one crystal form. It just looks as a function of energy. This technology came about available because of the synchrotron radiation. Because when we make X-rays at home, there's only one wavelength available. You make copper radiation. At a synchrotron, it's tunable. And so Wayne basically realized, well, actually, should give credit when credit's due. The first person to realize this and publish a paper on it with Keith, was Keith Hodson, who's in our chemistry department, who's now the director of the synchrotron lab. And Jerome Carl also had published some stuff. And Wayne also had done this. So it was sort of three different groups had sort of picked up on all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But Wayne was really the one who pioneered, you know, really pushed us and mm-hmm. said, I'm going to make this practical. Mm-hmm. And this involves instrumentation, because you have to make tunable optics at synchrotrons, which is not trivial. And Wayne developed a whole suite of programs to do this. So he really pushed us into a practical method. And so I was there when all this was being developed, and we really wanted to do it. And it turns out, so I said we had substituted lanthanide ions. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they are incredibly strong anomalous scatterers. So it was a great problem. And so we went off to France and did this experiment. We collaborated with a group in Paris when they had the optics set up to do it. Mm-hmm. And we did this, and it was very successful. Although we had a problem with the experiment, we didn't control the wavelength well. It was very hard to control the wavelength exactly. So we actually had to write a refinement procedure to refine these anomalous scattering effects out of the data, and it was kind of a real messy problem, but you know, we did it. And that was sort of my main methodological contribution, was this kind of refinement procedure. Sort of wrote the code to make it more generally applicable, and in fact it's now pretty widely, mm-hmm. you know, that idea is sort of used by everyone, in fact. And and we solved the structure. We got a beautiful, you know, electron density map out of it and solved mm-hmm. the structure from that. And that was actually the science paper that I sent you, was that work. So that was sort of the most important thing mm-hmm. I had done. Then what happened was that, in fact, the crystals I originally grew were actually a co-crystal with calcium with a big oligosaccharide that cross-linked the crystal together. So now we're able, very quickly, we collected data on that and then solved the structure of the co-crystal so we could see how these interacted directly with sugars. That was the Nature paper I sent to you from Wayne's lab. That was the other sort of major bit of work. You know, so we really had solved, that was the first structure done of that whole family, and then we got the first information about how these actually interact with their ligands. And that then has spurred Kurt and our lab to continue looking. We've been able to use that as a basis for engineering other specificities mm-hmm. into that protein. We've done a lot of protein engineering to basically create new specificities to understand how the whole family recognizes its ligands, and that's kind of ongoing work now in our lab mm-hmm. to this day. Basically what happened is that Wayne was very generous. Kurt and I wanted to continue this collaboration, and Wayne let me take the project with me, which was actually very important for me to get my lab going. Uh-huh. It's very important, actually. And to this day, Kurt and I are still collaborating mm-hmm. on this work. So that was a very quick...
He was also very generous of him.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he was. And he had a lot of things going in his lab, and I think it was... You know, he realized, well, you know, Kurt wanted to continue with me anyway, I think, and mm-hmm. and Wayne just said, listen, you know, this is fine. You know, he agreed to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could have understood if he didn't want to, but he did, and it was really mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have a really good relationship, and so it was, you know, I had a great time there. So yeah, I consider him a really good friend, and it's, mm-hmm. It was nice.
Yeah. Now, how did that lab? You know, we talked a little bit about Wiley's lab. What was the sort of milieu of
totally
that lab?
It was totally different. Wayne is very much very self-confident in his ability to solve any problem, and didn't feel the need to sort of have many people on one project or anything like that. And everyone had their own project. And what linked the lab was really the methodology that was being developed. So it was a very interesting place from the crystallographic methodology point of view, and Wayne just would, you know, at that time work very closely with everyone, to you know on their particular problems, and he left you alone, but when you wanted help and advice, he was there, and he was, you know, always really constructive, and he just had, you know, really clear thinking about everything, and so he was a great mentor for postdocs, because if you were, you know, you're already kind of pretty independent, and you could just really talk at a pretty mm-hmm. high level with him and just kind mm-hmm. of do things. And I don't think he was, some of the students really foundered in his lab, the ones who needed more mentorship, because mm-hmm. Wayne is just very kind of hands-off, and I don't mean that in a bad way. He just was very busy at the mm-hmm. time. He was involved in way too many things. Even he acknowledges that. And so some of the students kind of really were a little bit lost, because the downside of not having people working in sort of related projects is that they don't really have sort of direct peers to interact mm-hmm. with and get help from. So, yeah, we would all try to help everyone else out, of mm-hmm. course, but it isn't quite the same. And mm-hmm. Wayne just wasn't around that much. Mm-hmm. He was gone a lot. He's traveled a lot. Mm-hmm. He's involved in a lot of different activities. And so for some of the students, they really foundered. The ones who did well, though, were fantastic. I mm-hmm. mean, so there were a couple of really terrific students there who did really well. Mm-hmm. The postdocs, it was the same kind of thing. But, you know, but for me, it was great. I didn't need much day-to-day guidance, but
sure.
to have, you know, someone who really, really knew crystallography at mm-hmm. you know, at an incredibly deep level. You know, I just learned so much from the guy, so it was just great, you know, being mm-hmm. able to talk to him. And of course, I had the advantage of having Kurt down the hall. So, mm-hmm. on the sort of my biological mm-hmm. end of the project, I had Kurt, mm-hmm. and so we would talk, and we got along really well. And so it was just an ideal situation. And it was really, really a happy situation for me. The lab generally was you know, Wayne is very kind of calm, and he doesn't kind of keep a high-pressure environment in the lab at all. Probably not high-pressure enough at some, you know, for some people, I guess. You know, I mean, as I said, some people can drift, but it was just a really nice environment. I mean, he's just a really nice guy, mm-hmm. and very constructive, and, you know, you say, okay, here's what, you know, to try. And so it was just a very, very different environment from my graduate lab. And it was good, because I think, for the most side, there were a lot of ups to that. There are some downs. I mean, I think having a little more cohesion, you know, cohesion on some of the projects that are going on, and also I think people did have a tendency to drift a little bit in the lab. And so, again, I think from both labs mm-hmm. I took away positive and negative mentorship.
Sure.
And I think having those kind of very orthogonal lab experiences was very good, because I think I took away good and bad things from both labs. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, I mean, I think I just really love Wayne's lab. I mean, it was uh-huh. just a great time. Mm-hmm. It's a great time. Yeah.
How was your social life doing at this point?
It was fairly disastrous in graduate school. At Columbia, it was good. I mean, I always had girlfriends there, but I'm still not married, in fact. I have a girlfriend here. No, it was fine, you know, but, you know, worked very hard. It was people, you know, yeah. at work, and, mm-hmm. you know, I knew at Columbia, that kind of thing. But basically, it was fine. So, yeah, I just overall had a very
good time, nice time in your life.
Yeah. I mean, there was a very rocky, right, the year, last year I left was terrible, because I had, well, not 2 years before, I guess, I'd broken up with someone, and that was very hard, and I was very miserable, and it definitely affected my work and my interactions with people in the lab. I was very kind of withdrawn for a while, very, very unhappy. And I had the additional stress of that's when I was looking for a job, so it was kind of a lot of stuff was going on then. Mm-hmm. But that was a bad period, definitely. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, it was fine.
Yeah. Good time.
It was I look back very fondly on my 4 years there. Mm-hmm. I really do. Yeah.
Well, this would probably be a good time to break, and we'll pick up tomorrow and continue.